America is just really stuck.
Hi, I'm Nick Lesby for Reason TV, and today we're talking with Chris Novoselic, best known as the co-founder and bassist of Nirvana, one of the very most influential music groups of the past quarter century. The release of Bleach, Nevermind, and In Utero not only mainstreamed what became known as grunge, but helped to forever end what was once known as the mainstream. But he's pushing to create an alternative approach to electoral politics. In 2004, he published Of Grunge in Government, Let's Fix This Broken Democracy, and is chairman of Fair Vote, a nonprofit that lobbies for electoral reforms such as instant runoffs and proportional voting. He's also active in his local Grange chapter and writes that he is looking for a new political home. Welcome, Chris Novoselic.
Thank you, Nick, and thanks for having me here at Reason.
All right. No, it's our pleasure. You know, we're sitting here partly because of a piece you wrote for a new edition of a book about Celine Dion. Your essay at the time was titled, Why the World Needs Celine Dion Fans. Explain what you meant by that.
It's about trying to find the humanity in people. And not that you need to agree with others, but say if you share a goal, maybe you can find a way to work together. And there was a time when the line was drawn between like mainstream and alternative, the underground, this and that. And I was part of that world. You know, maybe I was, you know, alienated youth or whatever. And then in 1991, I found myself in the biggest band in the world. So it helps you change your perspective
right.
on things. So I do feel like kind of like a misfit. Usually I feel inside I'm a misfit, like right. I don't really watch sports or a lot
despite
of
despite being 12 or 13 feet tall.
Yeah, I don't play. Yeah, I'm the tallest man in the world.
That's right.
And
yet you don't play baseball or basketball or volleyball or but we'll talk about Celine Dion. I mean,
well,
so,
I'm not
so
a, I don't yeah. really listen to Celine yeah. Dion. I like to one of my favorite things to do is to like in my home in the hills in Washington State, is to curl up by my wood stove and have a glass of wine and like put on a record, you know, and it's like, and then listen to the, you know, this vinyl or even a high definition digital sound, you know, just to feel the music. I don't think I'd ever do that with Celine Dion.
But you talked in the piece about how, you know, when it comes to political organizations, you know, how does somebody from Nirvana or somebody you mention in either in that piece or in the response to a blog post I did, you know, like, so you have Flipper fans on one hand, you know, and you don't expect Flipper fans, much less people from Nirvana, being in a room with Celine Dion fans, but you can have a common purpose. And how you know, what does that mean? How does that bring people
together? If you look at the Smells Like Teen Spirit video, and it's like set in this high school, and the high school goes crazy, and there's these cheerleaders, and they have that Anarchy A symbol mm-hmm. on there. And so that's something that we brought along with us from growing up in the underground scene, because that symbol was so prevalent. And it really made a lot of that symbol made a lot of sense in that scene, because it was like independent structures, and young people are finding each other, and they're working towards common goals, making a community outside the corporate and the government sphere. One of the tenets of anarchism is that groups should be temporary, so that way the bureaucracy doesn't come in and you have this group just to perpetuate the group. You want to meet this goal, okay? So if you're in a group that's, you know, temporary and you're working towards a goal, you can, there's space to work with all, you know, all people from all kinds of walks of life.
And so you focus on the commonality rather than the point of difference.
Yeah, and we focus on the goal. Like I'm never going to convince him how he feels about this or that or change his mind, and he probably won't make me, but we're not talking about that. You know, right. We want to do something. We want to change elections.
Well, yeah, so let's talk about Fair Vote. You've said that one of the goals that you and the organization have is to get more people more involved in politics.
Right.
What are the voting reforms that you champion, and how do they accomplish that idea of getting more people involved?
Well, I'd like to see a new paradigm in our election system. There's so much cynicism, and people are angry. Things are really out of whack. And the lawmakers have circled the wagons. They've just built these structures and barriers.
And by that you mean, I mean, it's like if you're a Democrat or a Republican, it's kind of like, you know, your Avis or Hertz or the Yankees and the Red Sox, and you've rigged the field so that it's really hard for somebody else to kind of break in.
Yeah, that's exactly, that's what I'm talking about. And so how do we change things? And so, and it seems like our politics is so old, like it's almost seems like turning on the TV and there's ABC and CBS and NBC, and you know, there's one newspaper in town, right. And so they're all pushing things on us, and that's all going away.
Mm-hmm. And certainly in every other part of our lives.
They want to pull us in.
Right.
That's the new paradigm. It's flipped over completely. Now you're trying to pull people in, but the election system is set up on the push paradigm, and I think that's why there's this disconnect.
So what does FairVote?
We want proportional representation. Okay, and so these are systems that are in use in the United States. They're constitutionally protected, okay? And they have an American flavor. They speak to American values. So like in Europe, you vote for a party. Mm-hmm. In the American version, you vote for the person.
Okay, and so walk me through this. So let's say you have a legislature in Washington State.
Okay.
And there's 10 slots. How does it work from there?
Well, that'd be a very liberal version of what we're talking about, having a 10-seat district. We're saying more like 3, 4, 5-seat districts.
Okay.
Okay, so you'd have your district. And say for United States House of Representatives, okay, we have a plan to how to reform that. So we would take 3 districts and combine them into 1 district. Mm-hmm. So you'd have 3 representatives representing you. And then we would just change the ballot a little bit. Mm-hmm. So the simplest way to do it would give voters 1 vote to elect 3 candidates. So what does that mean? It means it takes 25% of the vote to get elected. Okay, so everybody votes, you count the votes, and then basically the top 3 vote getters win.
As long as they all cross a minimum threshold.
The threshold is fluid because it depends on how many candidates and how many votes they get. Well, this system's kind of a plurality system. It's semi-proportional. Okay.
And candidates could be independent. They could be affiliated with any given party.
Absolutely. Yeah. You can have parties nominate candidates. You can have independents. Mm-hmm. It's candidate centered. This system that I'm explaining right now is called a single non-transferable vote. Mm-hmm. And it's used in like school board elections in the United States and some places, usually where there's a Voting Rights Act settlement where they can't make this majority-minority district.
Right.
So they go to this modified at-large system, like single non, or cumulative voting, where you can, like if you have 3 seats, you can give her all 3 of your seats.
Right.
And then—
So it's like, yeah, out of these 10
votes,
people,
votes.
Yeah, out of these 10 people, vote for any 3,
mm-hmm.
and you could either vote all of your votes for 1 person or spread them around.
Right. See, yeah. And so what you nailed right there was is you explain the at-large type voting that a lot of people are used to. You get 3 seats, you get 3 votes, you vote for him, her, and him. So this way, it's a little more sophisticated, and so you give the voters, they have a little bit of work to do, but you know, not a lot. But why is that sophistication important? Because it depends on where that's sitting, okay? Because when you have these insiders, politicians, when they make these single-member districts, they draw them to suit them.
Right.
That's called gerrymandering, and they use tons of sophistication, computer models or whatever.
Gerrymandering is like as old as America itself, right? It's named after Elbridge Gerry, who I think may have even signed the Constitution.
Elbridge Gerry. Some of these election control nuts are like, not nuts, but I mean wonks. Like I'm a nut, I'm an election reform nut. And like, but some people are like, don't you think we should be calling it gerrymandering? Because his name was Elbridge Gerry. I'm like, sure. Whatever
but
you want.
I mean, what you're saying is we need to replace an abuse of electoral or representative democracy that's as old as the country with things that have been going on since the beginning of the country.
Somebody still has to draw these multi-member districts. Like when in Europe, it's one big district. Like Israel is one big district. Okay, we're saying there should be, with FairVote, there should be these independent commissions, all right, that keeps the politicians out of the process, that draw these multi-member districts.
What kind of support are you finding? Or who are the people that are into this or backing this? Because clearly, you know, we know Republicans and Democrats, the one thing they always agree on is to do whatever they can to keep
third
parties off the ballot.
They're terrible. These hacks and insiders, they're the worst. And we've been fighting them for a long time, and we've won some and we've lost some.
So who are the people on your side?
Well, the people on our side, because I've been doing this since like 1997, and so we've made so much progress. But what's happening right now is with our dysfunctional Congress, gridlock, all the cynicism, people are looking at fair vote reforms. There's a book out last year, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, by scholars Norm Ornstein and Thomas Mann, and they're promoting ranked choice voting, this type of proportional representation. Editorial writers are giving it a look and writing in favor of it. And so it's just getting the message out, and people start thinking about it. It's like, well, maybe this is a viable solution.
Well, now, are people upset about gridlock? Because, I mean, on a certain level, we, you know, somehow, even though Congress has been gridlocked, we get higher taxes, we get more regulations.
Yeah, is it necessarily a bad thing that government's doing nothing? Or like, in Washington State, our legislature meets for like 2 months, and most of the year it's not in session. And so like when they adjourn, it's like, okay, we're off the hook now.
Right. And I mean, nobody in Washington is like the other 10 months of the year, they're not like, gee, I wish the legislature was
That's part of our political culture.
Session. Yeah.
Yeah.
So how do you self-describe politically?
I'm an anarcho-capitalist socialist. I don't know. I'm kind of a moderate. I think I'm moderate. Just a political
So you're
moderate.
An anarcho-capitalist socialist moderate.
You know, I'm a gun-owning pacifist. So there you go. I'm a anarcho-socialist. I mean, you know what I mean?
Anarcho-socialist, capitalist, gun-toting.
Yeah, it's just like, I don't know. You know, I'm just trying to make it work in this world. And basically, I'm a small D Democrat. I want to do this, change elections. That's my big issue. And a lot of things I should learn more about and try to keep up to speed on things. But I see a lot of myths and reactionary politics on the right and the left. And people seem like they're cut from the same cloth.
Well, talk about the Grange then, because this is a type of political organization or social organization you're involved in very heavily that seems to get away from cynicism, and it also seems to get away from gridlock, right? Because in the end, it's doing stuff despite whatever politics is going on.
The Grange was established in 1867, and it was William Kelly was the founder of the Grange, and he was tasked by President Johnson to tour rural America, just kind of
report. This is Andrew Johnson.
Andrew Johnson.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Who was vice president.
Yes.
Then after the assassination became president.
Right. Yes.
And so he did the tour, and he came back and said, yeah, rural America's hurting. Farmers are isolated, and they're getting exploited, and we need to do something. And Johnson really didn't do anything.
Right.
Do anything. So Kelly got some other folks together, a couple of them from, they were Masons, and they started this fraternal order called the Patrons of Husbandry. I feel connected to history because we do this ceremonial work, and I really love history, and so I'm like living it. I'm living like post-war, Civil War United States. And then it's also a community group. And we do like, you know, raise money to give it away. We have a farmer's market. Then there's a thread in the Grange also that's activist. It doesn't do partisan politics. Mm-hmm. It's a big no-no to endorse candidates or to get behind a campaign. However, like Washington State Grange was instrumental in passing a top two primary in Washington State. Mm-hmm. In 2004, and it was enacted in 2008.
Top two primary?
It's like a California system.
Okay.
They're calling it the jungle primary now. Mm-hmm. Okay, because, and
so it's just that whoever, there's open primaries, and whoever makes the top two candidates run in a general.
And that's a whole other conversation about what that does with association and the devices on the ballot and this and that.
Yeah, well, before we go off the Grange, you mentioned it's decentralized. Mm-hmm. Why is decentralization a virtue in cultural matters or in political matters or in social matters?
Well, I think it just goes back to the values that I grew up with in the punk rock world, because it was this decentralized world. And so we just made our own way. Like, we'd be anti-government or, you know, but we really didn't complain a lot. We were more action-oriented. Like, people were publishing fanzines, we were setting up shows, we were getting in vans and touring around, and we're associating with other people. So, you know, I just like that idea.
Yeah, is that, I mean, really, I mean, on a certain level, is that the political future that you're pointing towards, which is, okay, you're going to have government, you're going to have these large concentrated groups that are trying to control mm-hmm. everything, but whatever else you do, you just route around them. You get in your van and you drive
you
around.
You just make it happen. Yeah. What I did, like, and I don't think that corporations are these big bogeymen that right. a lot of people paint them to be, but instead of complaining about it, what I did is Grangemasters, I started a farmer's market. Mm-hmm. And so we're a nonprofit. And so our farmer's market is cool because we don't take any percentage from anybody. Mm-hmm. You know, and they're happy. We get, like, you know, people are happy to help the Grange. And
do you eat corporate vegetables on occasion?
All the time.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, let's talk about, a little bit about that, because in
beautiful vegetables from like Peru and California right. in like December and January. You know.
So what is it? I mean, because this is one of the great contradictions in kind of, it seems like, in punk rock or in rock and in entertainment more broadly, is that, you know, there's a lot of entrepreneurism, there's a lot of capitalism. I mean, because you made money buying, you made money selling records,
yes,
and selling
absolutely.
T-shirts and concert tickets. And yet so many rock stars, particularly from the alternative world, seem to be totally hostile towards corporation, even when they work for them. I mean, Rage Against the Machine were, you know, contract employees of Sony Corporation. And yet, what they sold was anti-corporate speak. Where is that mentality coming from?
I don't know. You know, corporation is just, you want to start a business, yeah. and you start a corporation with the Secretary of State, and every state has different rules
right.
about corporations, and you want to shield yourself. You could, you know, mm-hmm. that seems to be good for commerce, and corporation is a group of people, and if you want to come together for profit or nonprofit, that's your business, whatever you want to do.
Right.
And if you can do something illegal, I think, you know, there should be transparency, and, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of transparency with, you know, taxes. And
well, you know, when you the note that you wrote to Reason that we published, you mentioned you were in favor of the Citizens United decision, which allowed corporations to more freely speak on political terms. And you said, you know, because why would I be against groups
right.
of people being able to express themselves? That knocked people's socks off, because you don't expect to hear that from politicians, but especially from punk rockers.
It was the SOPA and PIPA. Mm-hmm. They
right.
had some
Stop Online Privacy.
Yeah, all that kind of deal.
Yeah.
And what happened is people got together with Google. Remember mm-hmm. Google had that black censor thing
yeah.
on? And they stopped that legislation dead in its tracks
mm-hmm.
super fast. My point is that people need to come together, and like money bombs, mm-hmm. Kickstarter campaigns.
You gave money in 2007, I think, to Ron Paul.
I did.
Ron Paul did not even invent the money bomb. One of his followers did and came
mm-hmm.
up with that concept and showed more than anybody up to that point, even Howard Dean in the 2004 election, that a lot of small contributions from a lot of people make a difference.
I was in the Palace Hotel in San Francisco, and there was a sign in the lobby, Ron Paul speaking at 2:00. And I'm like, it's 1:30. Mm-hmm. And so I went and I sat down, and then they were, you know, the suggested donation. So I gave like $100 or whatever, because I thought it'd be the decent thing to do instead of just like, you know, bums rushing or crashing the party. I asked the first question, you know.
What did you find interesting or captivating about Ron Paul? Because he's somebody who is able to speak, you know, he's a 70-plus-year-old obstetrician he's a professional politician. He can draw thousands of kids at a college campus. People on the left are digging him, people on the right.
That's what I was going to say, because yeah. a lot of his message just like overlaps.
Yeah. So what is it about that message that you think is pulling people
in? I think it's just more about a phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's just trying to, how are you going to catch that cat by the tail? And he did it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with the internet, and things go viral, and things that you would never imagine would take off. And this, you know, this character,
yeah.
obstetrician from Texas, is like this huge political celebrity.
What do you hope happens in, say, you know, 2014, we've got midterms coming later this year, in 2016, or does it matter to even be talking about Democrats and Republicans in this
context? Yeah, I was a Democrat for about 4 or 5 years, active Democrat, and I thought I could reform the party. Maybe I wasn't going about it right. Maybe somebody can and somebody will. I don't see it. It's just a top-down structure. It's a soft money conduit, and Nancy Pelosi, she's gonna lose the election again, and it's just like, what's the definition of insanity? Doing the same thing, wrong thing over and over again. Republicans, they have a real big demographic problem because they're the party of old white people, and they're not reaching out to folks, and. But their strategy is to just circle the wagons. It's just like all these barriers to voting and to ballot access and this just gerrymandering. That's their solution. But it's just so much tension. But I believe what's going to happen is that somebody's going to find that sweet spot between social networking and political association and capture the imagination. And people are trying it.
You've been talking a lot about it, people having ownership and being part of a group in the political process. It's one thing in the Grange because that's a voluntary association,
right,
or a band. Unless you're Ike Turner, membership in a band was voluntary, right?
Right.
Are there certain things that should be out of the political arena where a majority doesn't get to vote and say, yeah, this is the way it should be?
It can be like that, because what we do is we elect these representatives and they do the nuances, and we have initiative and referendum in Washington State, and it's a good thing and I support it, but it could be a rather blunt instrument. And populism, sometimes we vote for things that maybe should have been thought through a little better. And so when you go through the Republican, the representative democracy, small r,
right,
there's these lawmakers, and they have staff, and they can consult with experts and try to make some mm-hmm. good legislation.
Yeah. You mentioned in an interview I read about how the Republican Party, capital R, should really have been embracing anarchy, or if they were true to their rhetoric.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
Well,
or what do you mean by
you
that?
Have people making their own way,
yeah,
and making these structures, and there are these mega churches, and they have like their own daycare. They have auto repair. They have they offer people benefits,
insurance. Yeah.
And so they're making these structures. These are their collectives.
Right.
Is what they are. It's like it's anarchism.
Right.
And
I mean that's a good thing. And the question is why.
That's their business.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Whatever the mega church want to do, and you want to believe whatever your values are, and your beliefs, that's your business. You can do whatever you want to do. You build these structures, your daycare.
Yeah.
People want public daycare. Couldn't you, like, as a mommy or a daddy, couldn't you, do some kind of co-op, maybe?
Right.
Have some kind of, I'm sure they have those.
Well, now you're veering dangerously into small L libertarianism, right?
Right.
It's essentially, there's a government for certain things that can't be done on a voluntary basis.
Right.
But generally speaking, have people opt in more than being forced in.
Yeah, I think people get lazy. They're just like, let's just have this government program, but it's not really like public financing. I don't support public financing. Have you seen the bill in Congress for public financing?
I try not to, but
it's a big turd is what it is. And I'm not going to burn up our time explaining this big scheme, but there's a pilot program in 3 states. You get your My Voice voucher, and then there's this committee that is going to distribute the money.
And I mean, the idea of publicly supporting political races is no different than publicly supporting religion. It's an affront, right, to the to freedom of expression and whatnot.
Yeah, and that was with the Citizens United
mm-hmm.
case, because that group, Citizens United, they didn't want to reveal who their donors were, and the court said no. There's a public interest to know who your donors are. And second, there was that film, Hillary the Movie.
Mm-hmm.
Under those rules, you couldn't air that film on YouTube.
Right.
So if you want to repeal Citizens United, are you saying that we shouldn't have freedom of speech on YouTube?
Right.
You know, but what there is, there's this big myth. It's like, no, they created corporate personhood, and all of a sudden these big evil corporations with fangs and their werewolf kind of Lon Chaney Jr., who had fabulous hair, by the way, remember? But anyway, so on the left, there's just all this kind of like, there's this myth. Right. And it's just like, well, maybe you should read Citizens United. And what I'd like to see with public campaign finance is have no limits. Right. But 100% disclosure. And you know what? If a candidate's out there who are for public financing, why don't they do this? Every time you get a dime or a dollar or 10 bucks from somebody, within 24 hours, put it on your Twitter account. Why don't you make that pledge if you're for, you know, public financing?
Can I ask, there's a question though with forcing people to disclose publicly their support, right? Because what if you're doing something politically unpopular? I mean, you know, for instance, if you're going against a popular candidate or a popular law. That's
there was a lawsuit in Washington State. There was a pro-gay group. I'm pro-gay, right. You know, and they wanted access to the signatures on the referendum, so they can harass people who sign this referendum. And so there was a lawsuit that needed to be private, okay, and then the court said no. Because when you sign a petition, you're a legislator. Mm-hmm. And then Justice Scalia nailed it. He says, there's a certain amount of civic courage required. If you don't want people to know how you feel about something, don't say it, instead of slinking around. And that's what I was saying about like transparency, right?
So you're okay with mandating, get rid of all public funding of elections, but then mandate disclosure.
Or not public, not, well, right. Yeah, I don't support public funding of elections. Right. And I think that to get rid of all these caps and individual campaign contribution limits, okay? And that people just would encourage to give directly to a campaign.
But what about, take like the pro-gay group, like what, you know, assume it's 1975, or 1974 rather than 2014, and you're pushing a pro-gay agenda. You could also see here, you might not participate in the political process if you know coming out in favor of
some people did, like in the Stonewall riots, they got their heads smashed open. They had civic courage. Yeah. No one's going to someone's going to smash your head open. I mean, those people had a ton of courage, okay? Or civil rights, water cannons, dogs, lynchings, okay? That's a sad history of politics in America. I don't think it's that dire to put your name on a petition. So, and then don't do it if you don't want to do it.
Yeah.
Just don't do it. Go watch a movie or something.
Speaking of anarchism and courage, you played in a group in 1999 before the big World Trade Organization come. In Seattle, you played in a band feature. The Dead Kennedys' Jello Biafra was in it, as well as some people from Soundgarden, the No WTO combo. Yet you've also said that you were really disappointed with the anti-WTO protests in Seattle, specifically mentioning the destruction of a McDonald's as pointless and, you know, ridiculous. Talk a little bit about what do you mean by that?
Well, it was just, it seemed like it was violence. And like, because I went by some of the stores that I don't really eat at McDonald's, you know, but a lot of people do. And so there are these people who want, you know, they're socialists, but they hate people, you know, and so they go trash the McDonald's. And I just think it was just reckless violence, and they weren't trying to accomplish anything. And they said he was writing something on the wall, some kind of graffiti that was just stupid, cliche. And I said, hey, how would you like if someone did that to your house? And he yelled back, fuck you. And these other people started yelling, fuck you at me. I'm like, like I'm in trouble.
So you hightailed it out. Yeah.
I just left. Like, I'm done here. I played the show with the No WTO combo. Mm-hmm. You know, people are fighting for better wages or whatever, you know, environmentalism, the sea turtles, you know, trying to save animals. I like that. I support that.
Well, now, you know, it's 15, 16 years later. What do you think about the World you know, World Trade Organization. Is that a bad thing? Is that part of decentralization? Or let's put it outside of that, is globalization a good thing?
Globalization is a great thing, and the genie's out of the bottle. It's called the information revolution, and it has the promise to bring opportunity and information to all corners of the world. It's a wonderful thing, you know, and it's happening, and it's with, you know, like, so Marx he espoused communism, but he was off by a suffix. Mm-hmm. It's communication,
yeah.
And people speaking, and you know, I'm optimistic if we can keep the internet wide open, you know.
Yeah. And things like pushing back against things like the Stop Online Privacy Act, is a way to do that. And that was done, as you were saying, by a kind of ad hoc group of people coming together, crushing it, and then kind of disbanding. And
yeah, they're disbanded.
Talk a little bit about, you mentioned, I mean, you lived for a year, was it, in Croatia,
yeah,
in 1980?
Yeah.
What brought you there? I mean, you're Croatian-American, but what brought you there, and then what was your experience?
Well,
like?
It was very personal. I grew up in Los Angeles, California. I was 14 years old. I moved to Aberdeen, Washington, and I wasn't functioning very well. And so my parents were concerned. They go, well, let's send Chris to Croatia for a year.
So, was that to scare you, that like it could always get worse?
It was one of the best years, yeah, of my life. I mean, I loved it. It was enriching. It was culturally satisfying. Mm-hmm. I went to, the school was really hard, a lot harder than, I went to the gymnasia. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty neat, you know. I was 16 years old.
So. What did it teach you about communism? You know, the ideal versus the kind of lived reality of it.
I think and it's not so much communism as it's like a centralized state, mm-hmm, and people can be really cynical and corrupt, mm-hmm, because they work for ways around the state, or they don't trust the state, and you couldn't speak out. Mm-hmm. Against the state, and so things could get kind of sketchy.
Do you feel that experience, I mean, did that energize you to become part of a do-it-yourself, a DIY movement, or that you recognize the greater space in America to be DIY?
I don't know what effect that had. I think what the effect was culturally on me. So when I came back to the United States, I had been immersed in this other culture, and so there's a different world. So I came back in, and that might have had something to do with just feeling maladjusted or not fitting in, gravitating towards punk rock. I met Buzz Osborne, was, mm-hmm, a very important person who turned me on to punk rock. I met Kurt Cobain, right, and we gravitated towards each other, and we found other like-minded people. Most other people didn't like music, like Flipper. They thought Flipper was just out of tune garbage noise, yeah, and we were just like,
well,
this
Buzz
is sublime
Osborne
beauty.
Well, Buzz Osborne is one of the creators of the Melvins, who's,
yeah,
another band that's still around, like Flipper. These are incredibly long-lived
I
corporations.
Know.
Most,
yeah,
companies don't last this,
yeah,
long.
Exactly.
And they are noise to people, even people who love them, but especially people who don't. But there was something
noise.
Appealing.
It was beautiful.
Yeah.
Sublime, wonderful.
Talk I want to talk about music and that scene that you emerged in. But when you were talking about a sense of a wider world, you've also written about Jack Kerouac's, mm-hmm, influence, or reading The Dharma Bums and On, mm-hmm, the Road. And you know, how does that play into it? Because Jack Kerouac is somebody who, you know, Bob Dylan is, you know, he once said that Jack Kerouac is rock and roll. I mean, this is Kerouac's influence on rock. Is epic.
It's about walking out of a bar after a few drinks and just taking a breath of fresh air, and you're a little lit. Just like you're feeling, you know. And he was so ecstatic, mm-hmm, about so many things. So like ecstasy, just like, oh yeah, you know. And just, I don't know, On the Road, The Endless Highway, Climbing the Mountain, beauty,
can we
interesting
still be,
people.
Can we still be ecstatic in America today?
If you want to be, you, yeah, can.
So how do you do that? Because, I mean, it seems like on the one hand, it is, you know, every minute we turn around, it's like in this conversation, there's probably lead paint on the wall that's killing us, or,
yeah,
we had a Diet Coke that was too, you know, is
destroyed. You hear a song you like, start dancing. That's, mm-hmm, what I do. I'll just start dancing, and that's it. That's all there is to it. That's all it is.
So talk about meeting, you know, working with Kurt Cobain, coming out, and then eventually Dave Grohl joins Nirvana later. What was it, do you think, about the place and time that you were in that pulled together? And it's not just Nirvana. It was, you know, groups like Mudhoney and Soundgarden and Bikini Kill. There's too much going on to even mention everybody, but what was it that happened in that time and place?
In American hardcore music and punk rock music was very eclectic. It wasn't just this monolithic kind of, you know, punk rock riffs. I mean, Meat Puppets or like country rock, Butthole Surfers, psychedelia. There were just so many. It was very eclectic, and we came out of that environment, and you know, we liked heavy music and we liked melody. And we had a passion for playing. We took it seriously, and we rehearsed a lot, and we played a lot. And so, in the broader culture, there was rock and roll music. There was no number one rock record. The year before Nevermind, it's Rock Dead. And so you had these rock bands that had this, you know, they were very feminine. They had like soft, you know, hair, permanent dudes and makeup, and it's like, you know,
so this is Motley Crue,
and those kind of bands.
Cinderella.
Yeah, Cinderella. Yeah. They had that kind of thing going, and then we weren't really interested in those bands. We were, because we came out of this subterranean scene, and then Nirvana breaks big, and it's diametrically opposite. We have like facial hair and just kind of lager shirts, but we're all like sensitive and feminine.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah.
So, they had the macho swagger and we had the, you know.
The emo kind of.
Yeah, emo kind of thing. They looked like chicks, we looked like guys, but
right.
Yeah.
But so you sang was, like chicks, or you sang about feelings.
Yeah.
Was the mainstream waiting to be blown apart? I mean, because in a way, and this is simplifying things, but I mean, it's kind of great that through about 1990, there was still kind of a top 40 or a Billboard 200. You know, through the 90s, the only music there was alternative, because there was no mainstream. There was only alt rock, alt country, alt hip-hop.
And whoever came up with that wretched term, alternative music, because what they tried to do was like, okay, this music's coming up, then my theory is, okay, we got to do something about this because they're going to displace the regime. Well, let's call it alternative. And it kind of goes this way.
Right.
But instead it went shot up and pushed all that aside.
What was it like to, Nevermind was released in, 1992 or 91?
91, September 91.
And then it went to number one in January, correct?
Something
93,
like that.
Yeah. What was it like to realize suddenly that you were on top of the world?
It was unreal. We couldn't understand it. It was like, it was all trying to sink in. Then you're famous and you're getting recognized, you know, so you have to deal with that. And there's all these, you know, people around you that, well, who's this guy, like, you know what I mean? And,
you showed up in Berlin shortly after the Berlin Wall fell. What was that like?
3 days. It was amazing because there was electricity in the air, and we were in West Germany, and then we came up to the East German border. There's that transit road to Berlin, and we counted it 50 kilometers of those Trabant cars, and they were giving marks to everybody who came over from the East, and we played a show. You know, Berlin was a lot of great energy, but the funny part is that we went to Hamburg after that Berlin gig, and that Reeperbahn. Mm-hmm. And all those Trabant cars are all over there in like strip clubs.
So
bars.
This is the minute
freedom.
Freedom, and they go to places that have been drawing, sailors and prostitutes and gambling and liquor. Was there a politics in Nirvana? I mean, you guys drove around for hours. Did you and Kurt Cobain or Dave Grohl or Pat Smear, the great guitarist for the Germs? Was there a shared politics or a lack of interest in politics or what?
There was a shared politics. I think it was just, you know, lefty stuff, but, you know, not very, very, it wasn't very deep, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, and we grew up against Reagan, you know, and because our punk rock scene was like, you know, and so anti-Reagan, Bonzo goes to Bitburg.
Right.
Let them eat jelly beans.
Yeah.
That whole thing. And then, like, Kurt sent $200 to Jerry Brown for president in 1992. And I'm like, Kurt, you got to said the rule is $100. He really liked Jerry Brown. So he wasn't really, Kurt wasn't a radical, into radical politics.
There seems, particularly in kind of DIY culture and a lot of punk and proto-grunge, you know, bands would be holding shows, and they were the embodiment of what I would consider a kind of libertarian entrepreneurial ethos of saying, like, you know what, we're having a thousand flowers bloom, we're doing our own thing, come and watch us if you want or not. But inevitably at those types of shows, the literature was always kind of like hard left or liberal democratic, very much top down, you know, there's one good way to do things. You know, why do you think there was such a, you know, the default politics of kind of subversive music inevitably seems to be, you know, hard left?
I can just only speculate, you know, just bleed over, like we have this two-party system, and then you look at the political system and you're just kind of like, you know, cherry picking, and maybe you have two choices. And so, well, we'll pick the Democrats because Republicans are, it's Reagan and he's on don't eat jelly beans, or you know, they're petty nationalists or something. And it's a structural, you don't get a lot of choices. Or you go look at a ballot and there's really nobody on the ballot, or it's a Republican and a Democrat, or just uncontested. And so it's just how moribund the political system is, and it's only gotten worse.
And so, I mean, there's at some point it's got to snap, right? Because on one part
it's
of our lives,
break.
I mean, there's, you know, 100 different versions of Pop-Tarts in the supermarket aisle, and yet you've still got, you know, Romney versus Obama, or Nancy Pelosi versus John Boehner on the other side. Like, something's got to give.
Yeah, then you vote in San Francisco and it's only Nancy Pelosi, mm-hmm. you know. There's a plan for proportional representation in California. Michael Lattner, he's a political scientist from the San Luis Obispo, the school there, and he wants to have these 5-member districts for the state assembly. So you would have Republicans coming out of the Bay Area in Los Angeles. So what would that look like? You'd have gay Republican guy, you know, and people would vote for him, and he'd have his platform, and he'd be very liberal on a lot of things, but, you know, fiscal conservative. Mm-hmm. And then you'd have Democrats coming out of rural California, where I live. My Democrat, we have 3 Democrats in our district, and they have NRA endorsements. Mm-hmm. And 2 of those Democrats actually killed a gun control legislation bill in the state house. They went, the leadership sweated them, and they said, we can't do it, because, and it wasn't the NRA or the lobbyist, or they just felt that their vote was in tune with their constituency. Mm-hmm. So there is, you know, there is a connection there.
And you got to love that, right? I mean, just things, I assume, if nothing else, you're interested in mixing up categories that we think are just parts of, you know, facts of nature.
Yeah, and so so in California, under this plan, it'd be like most everybody would have representation. And again, room for independence. Mm-hmm. And third parties, and people get more choices. And it's just kind of thinking out of the box just a little bit with how you do the ballot. And so then, you know, question with the music, if we had a robust political culture, maybe more ideas would come over into the music culture or whatever. Mm-hmm. Just America is just really stuck.
Talk, you in your book of Grunge and Government, you talk a little bit about the difference between Kurt Cobain as an individual and then as a kind of iconic savior. What do you mean by that? And
apotheosis is the word, when there's just this human phenomenon when somebody dies. You know, Che Guevara. There's that photograph, that iconic photo that just captures the imagination. Right. It's the most reproduced photograph of the 20th century. Alberto Korda was a photographer. And just people tend to do that. There's this something about they create a deity or it's
what do you think it is about Cobain or Kurt that speaks to so many people? I have a 20-year-old son who loves Nirvana, and he, you know, and there's, you know, what is it about Kurt and his death, you think, that allow people to project or to speak through
it's
him?
I think the music was like, because he left, you know, when you die, you die young, stay pretty. Mm-hmm. And then the music is so powerful and the way he expressed it. And so like, cause we just resurrected Nirvana last week. Mm-hmm. And we had a real challenge, like how are we gonna do this? Because it's a big shoes to fill. So one of the things, well, I wanted to do Joan Jett because I love Joan Jett.
And this is, you're talking about at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You were inducted.
Right. We were inducted. So we played four songs.
Right.
And so like, well, Dave, let's do Joan Jett. He's like, I love Joan, let's do Joan. And we're thinking, he goes, hey, guess what? And Dave's like, let's just have all women do it. I'm like, oh, that'd be a good way to do it.
Is part of it that Kurt was he was like too beautiful for this world. He was too sensitive. He was incapable of, I mean, is that part of the icon, not even of the real life?
I think he was sensitive, and then it was the drug abuse. Mm-hmm. That was just, you know, he couldn't, that was a big part of it.
So, I mean, it's
he was under a lot of pressure, and, you know, he made a bad choice. He was probably pretty ripped when mm-hmm. he decided to do what he did. If he would have had a clear mind, mm-hmm. he wouldn't have done it.
So, I mean, it's less, you know, it's kind of less symbolic, and it's more, or it's more just a chemical thing that he was probably drunk or high or tripping.
He was high on heroin.
Yeah. In terms of drug legalization, I've read, you've said that you've never done hard drugs.
No.
I assume, though, that you believe that drugs in general should be legal. Mm-hmm. And why is that, if they're dangerous?
Well, I've never done hard drugs because it never really appealed to me. Mm-hmm. And I like, you know, growing up in my 20s, there was these, you know, Will Shatter, a bass player, Flipper, he overdosed on heroin. That was really hard on the band too. We talked all about that. And then there was this people in Seattle that I knew in the Seattle music community that died around the same time. And I'm just like, who would ever want to do heroin? It's a killer, you know? And
yes, there's that huge myth.
Yeah,
about it,
William S. Burroughs and this and that. And yeah, those myths, and myth is a myth. Mm-hmm. And in the end, it's chemical dependency. It's not romantic, is what it is. It's, you know, just go down and look at the methadone people. Mm-hmm. It's like, is it really that romantic? You know, people are strung out. And in Washington State, they legalized the pot. Mm-hmm. And so now there's this gold rush mentality that we're going to have a pot farm, we're going to have a pot retailer office and our pot retailer store. And we'll see what happens with that. But I think a lot of people are going to eat their shorts financially because the prices are going to collapse. Then there was a story in the Los Angeles Times a couple years ago where the marijuana growers in Mexico are switching to opium because there's no money in pot anymore. And the guy's like, I hate this legalization. You know what I mean? So the prices are going to go collapse, and it's just going to be...
And yet, I mean, it's better to have it legal so people aren't going to jail.
People aren't going to jail. You can put all those prosecutions and all those resources into treatment.
It is, you are almost 50. You were born in 1965, so you're coming up on that. Clearly, this music thing is over. Mm-hmm. You know, politically, fair vote probably won't get anywhere. You are going to college now. So you still have time to, you know, work towards a pension. What are you studying in college?
I'm doing social sciences, mm-hmm. and I'm working towards a degree in social sciences. So I'm doing my undergraduate, and I really like it. You know, I had the time to do it. I have the time. I only go half the time, and it keeps me engaged, keeps me out of trouble. And right now I'm studying geology and anthropology, which anthropology is really cool. It has to do with psychology and dreaming. Geology, now every time I'm in a park or out in the, I just look at a rock and think about it.
How difficult is it to tell your professors, you know, I'm going to miss Thursday.
It's online school.
Oh, okay, I was going to say, I'm going to miss Thursday's class because I'm being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall.
I go to school online, which is beautiful. And that's the only reason I did it. It was just made sense. I do some small-scale farming, but so we can grow our own food and sell some extra at the farmer's market. And, but I don't, you know, I have people who help me do that. And plus, I can afford to be a farmer because if I were a commercial farmer, that's a tough business. And so, it's a luxury. So, like the luxuries that I choose are like not necessarily a Learjet or a Palm Springs second home. It's just like, I can hire somebody to help with the garden.
Yeah, you know? And for that, how big a change is the technology? I mean, you mentioned, so you're doing, Fair Vote is being enabled by, or a lot of political action by online things. Mm-hmm. Nirvana crested right before kind of the internet blew mm-hmm. up the record mm-hmm. business. What kind of effect is that having? Do you generally think it's a good thing or a bad thing?
It's changed
intellectual property, intellectual property law as much as practice.
Well, it's changed attitudes about intellectual property, but I don't think it's changed the law. I think there's a lot of people who, they have a double standard. It's like music should be free, but computer software shouldn't, you know? And if I want to take all the Nirvana songs, which I don't, I think it's great that there's all this free Nirvana music out mm-hmm. there, okay? But if you want to buy the good stuff, then you buy the booklet with the great paper, the photographs, the DVD, mm-hmm. the high remix right. stuff. We know how to make money online, but, okay? And I love going on YouTube and watching, rare Rolling Stones or rare Nirvana, and it's free and it should be. So it kind of... There's a balance there.
So there's an adaptation going on.
There's an adaptation, but if I want to be a dipshit and say, what I want to do is put out Nirvana on an 8-track tape and I'm going to sell them on a corner here for $100 and nobody buys it, was it against the law to be a dipshit? But these people, these people are also like, no, you've got to give your music away. It's like, right. Well, don't tell me what to do with my music. There's tons of other bands out there. You just want it. You have a double standard is what you do. It's like Microsoft could have intellectual property, but a musician can't. It's the same old song and dance where the musician gets screwed.
One of the odd things about rock stars is that oftentimes they're great capitalists, but they're anti-capitalists. Mm-hmm. They oftentimes have guns, but tend to be anti-gun or anti-violence. Now, where you're at, you own guns?
I own guns. Yeah. I think they're a good tool to have out in the country, and I should be able to protect my home and my family. Mm-hmm.
What kind of guns do you have?
I have pistols and semi-automatic rifles, shotgun. I have chickens. You need a shotgun. You get a raccoon in there, they'll wipe you out. So if I couldn't shoot a raccoon, I wouldn't have fresh eggs.
When people, especially in D.C., talk about guns, it's always there's either nut jobs who own guns or pure Americans who don't. So, I mean, how big a benefit is it for you to have grown up and come out of a world where the lines aren't that clear?
Yeah, and then people in like Croatia in 1992, 1993, a lot of people got caught without guns or on the wrong end of the gun. So you never, it's really hard. And you live in Washington, D.C. or urban area, and, maybe you want, you have some kind of local law that you want to have a gun control, maybe that's, the way to go instead of broad-based protections. But it's really complicated, constitutional issues and court deals. Background checks, like that sick kid that shot up the Sandy Hook, those guns were legal. His
right.
mom was probably
Big
more
gun.
To blame than than him, and he had mental problems. There was a profile on him in the New Yorker, and that kid had a lot of issues, and he had access to guns, and it's really hard. And some people want background checks, and some people don't want to have mm-hmm. background or the gun show exclusion, and they don't want the gun show.
But you like your guns.
I like my guns, because it just makes me more comfortable. Like, I live way out in the country, and what I would do, like if something was going really bad, what I would do is I would call the police. First thing I would do, and just wait and see what my options were. But you have, if it's a raccoon or coyotes I have goats. The coyotes in the
Are you a better shot than Ted Nugent?
Probably not.
Okay. Are you a better musician than Ted Nugent?
Well, no, because I don't really play guitar. So he's done Stranglehold, Great White Buffalo, that riff on Great White Buffalo. And he plays those big open body Gibsons. He's got his own thing going. So I'm not gonna put it down. But what I don't really in his like reactionary politics. And he's a lot like people on the left. He did, you know what I mean?
What is your guilty pleasure? Do you have any guilty pleasures in terms of music?
Oh yeah, Melanie Sofka. That's a guilty big guilty.
And
pleasure.
What does she?
She was a folk singer in the late 60s.
Oh, I mean, you're talking about Melanie Brand New Key?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
That's a guilty pleasure.
Yeah, that's.
She's great. You know, actually, I have all her records.
Really? And she was on what, like Buddha Records?
She was on Buddha
like
Records,
yeah,
and she did that song Lay Down, Candles in the Rain or something. Mm-hmm. And then she had a lot of hits, but then she has been erased from music history.
Why does that happen to certain people?
I don't know. It happened
because
to Iggy Pop.
Huge, yeah.
It's Stalinist revisionism. It's the program directors of FM classic rock stations. Yeah. And it's just like, do you know that book, The Commissar Vanishes?
Yes, very much
it's
so.
The
it's
same
actually
thing.
On the shelves.
It's
here,
on the
so
shelf
like, yeah.
here. It's just the same thing. Yeah. It's just like Stalinist revisionist. Mm-hmm. They just airbrushed her out.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. Thank you so much. I'm Nick Gillespie for Reason TV, and we've been talking with Chris Novoselic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.